Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Fireside Chat, my chance to give you some thoughts about life and take questions from you wherever you happen to be watching. So I'd like to note this week that we have something new and something, I think, important to make Fireside Chat possible. Obviously, you know everything at PragerU is free, including the Fireside Chat. And everything costs, not me, but it's a serious operation, as you well know. So we have something called Prager United, and where people donate to PragerU $35 a month, which may sound like a serious sum to many of you, and I appreciate that. My own view is that I know no one who ever said I gave too much charity. You know, I ought to do, not today, I want to do something about giving charity. I've really thought this issue through because I admit I rather spend money on things I would like, my family would like, my wife would like, than give charity. I fully acknowledge it, but I really do give charity. And so I represent, so to speak, the normal human being. Anyway, $35 a month, you most won't feel it, I have to say, and you will be doing immense good. And now they are devoting that $35 overwhelmingly to the Fireside Chat, which makes me feel wonderful, actually. So there are a number of benefits, including 4 times a year you will get a gift from PragerU for the $35 donation. And one other thing, every week at the Fireside Chat, your question or someone in Prager United will be the first question that I respond to. Again, PragerUnited.com. Thanks a lot. I'm going to talk to you today about hell. So let me tell you why I thought about this. The Wall Street Journal just had a piece by one of its columnists about hell. It's titled, How We Think About Hell. And this was I think it was the opening sentence. Pope Francis was asked earlier this year what he thinks about hell. It's difficult to imagine it, he replied. What I would say is not a dogma of faith, to his credit. He said, I'm not talking now from a religious, official religious perspective, but my personal thought, I like to think hell is empty. I hope it is. Okay. Now, my point is not to differ with the Pope. My point is the point. The Pope is not the issue, but I have to offer you the source of the quote. I don't agree. I don't hope that hell is empty. I hope that in the future, hell will be empty. But right now, I don't hope it's empty. I would go further. I would say that if no one is punished, call it hell, I don't care what you call it. I call it punishment. I don't have an issue with the word hell, but if no one is punished for evil, then I would cease being a religious person. My faith is predicated in large measure on God being just and compassionate, and that those two together mean that he rewards the good and punishes the bad. I'm not going to get into the theological question of faith. I'm talking just about behavior right now. If Mao, that sadist who slaughtered 60 million, caused staggering suffering to 1 billion people, if he has the same fate as, let's say, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the Protestant minister, pastor in Germany, who disagreed publicly with what the Nazis were doing to the Jews, and the Nazis executed him for it. If Bonhoeffer and Mao, or Stalin, or Hitler, or the baby rapist in your city, if they have the same fates, God is not just. And in fact, if God is not just, call me an atheist. But I don't relate to a mentality that says, I don't want anyone punished. The idea that I hope hell is empty means I hope no one is punished. But why would I hope that? Now, as I said, I hope that people will be so good that in the future, there really is no punishment after life. People are so good, everybody goes to heaven. Okay, I would love that. But in the real world in which you and I live, it is, let me put it to you this way, and I'm being vulnerable in saying this. That's my sanity keeper. If you read about what Hamas did on October 7th, 2023, the burning of families alive, the horror, not just rape, but the torturous rape of women and so on, and you don't hope that there's a God that punishes them? We have a different God, with all respect. Not only that, there's another reason. A number of professors did a study and found that societies that believed in hell had less crime than societies that only believed in heaven. I care more about good and evil than about anything. That's my nature. We all get our own nature. That's my nature. And it has been since I was a child. So if belief in hell, that is punishment for bad deeds, and I don't mean any bad deed. I mean, that's why I said God is just and merciful. People who repent in this life, who make up for their bad deeds by doing good deeds, by giving back to a person they have hurt. I mean, of course, then God judges that, and that's important. But for the unrepentant bad, and, you know, some people will say, well, we're all sinners. Of course we're all sinners. You might as well say we're all people who do good. I can't believe there's anybody who never did anything good. So, but it's the sum total of a person's life that matters. So anyway, a society that believes that people are punished for bad will have less bad in it. That's been shown by people who are not even religious, just professors who studied that issue. So I just needed to react. It doesn't make you mean if you want people punished for really bad things. I think it makes you kind. Those of you who love God must hate evil. That is in the Bible, for those of you who are religious and for whom that matters. It's a command. The Hebrew has a command form. You must hate evil. In English, we don't have a command form in verbs, so we say must or have to or need to. In other words, if you don't hate evil, you don't love God. So you'll say, well, okay, I hate evil, but I don't hate the evildoer. All right, but if you really hate evil, that's fine with me. You will want it punished. The idea that the good and the bad have the same fate, as I said, would render me an atheist. My sanity rests on ultimate justice from a good God. Okay. And now time for your questions. Okay. From a Prager United donor.
Hi, Dennis. I'm a longtime listener, a big fan since Religion on the Line. Now that I have a granddaughter, I would like you to talk about cell phone use and social media for children. I have an idea of what you're going to say because I know what I believe, but you're always able to articulate so much better than I am my own thoughts. So I would like you to talk about this. Thank you.
As is my wont, I am going to comment on the last point you made and then answer your question about the role that I play in many people's lives, and I'm well aware of it. People tell it to me, wherein I often will say things that people already believe or know, but I say it in a better way than they have articulated it. This is not a brag. That's my gift. Everyone has gifts, by the way. And I am not, you know, a feel good, leading with the heart type guy. Everyone has gifts. You may not know what yours are, and that's something worthy of exploring. That's worthy of its own. How do you know your gifts? That's a great topic that we should get into. So I know that I play that role. Now, having said that, I'm not sure that I can answer your question better than you can. It's so self-evident that there is a destructive aspect to social media that equally it's got to be obvious that parents would want to limit the time that their child can spend on social media. Now, if you have a child who is studying medieval history and is looking up facts about medieval history or reading a book on Kindle, I mean, obviously, that's not what we mean by the problem of social media. No one argues that it's that extended use of it is a good thing. I actually have a living experiment, and that is my own grandchildren. I have two grandchildren, and hopefully I will have more through my younger son, who is hoping he has a wife, and they're hoping to start a family. But right now I have two grandchildren through my older son. And when I visit them, they live in Florida, I live in California, but we see each other a fair amount, thank God. So when I visit them, they are observant Jews, or Orthodox Jews, if you will, and therefore they don't use electricity one day a week from sunset on Friday, because in the Jewish calendar, days begin at sunset, not at midnight, until sunset or dark of the next day, of Saturday night. So for 24, 25 hours, they don't use electricity. That means no social media. So this is what I see when I visit my son's house. I feel that I'm transported via a time machine into the 1950s, where all I see, or I guess 60s or 70s, but you get my point, or if you will, 1940s, 30s, 20s, all I see is a whole bunch of kids. One is 13 and one is, what is he, 8. And they have a house filled with friends their age from school, and all they're doing is playing. None of them is watching a screen. They're just playing with each other. You don't see that much today. Even when kids do get together, they're often looking at their phones or looking at a screen on a tablet or perhaps at a desktop computer or watching something on a big screen. But there's none of that. They are just playing. The ill effects of social media are obvious. I'm giving you perhaps a less obvious bad part, not relating to real people. When I was a kid, when you were a kid, if you wanted a diversion, so you had a hobby, which kids do not have today. They don't have hobbies, generally speaking. They're not, you know, boys are not building radios or building computers or building even just model ships. My brother used to put model ships together. I mean, there were so many hobbies. I had stamp collecting and coin collecting and listening to radio broadcasts from around the world on a shortwave radio. I mean, I had so many hobbies. I still do. So, and then there's, what did you do? You called up your friend. If you wanted to relate, you called up a friend. The big problem when I was a kid was parents were saying, oh, my daughter, she spent so much time on the phone with her friends. Parents would yearn to have that problem today. Oh, my daughter, she's talking to human beings too much. That's not a danger. It really shows how generations don't appreciate it, totally understandably. She, you know, she's on the phone too much. That's not, it doesn't happen now. They text. By the way, I'm a big fan. I'm not a radical. I'm a big fan. I text a lot. I think it's a great thing. But God knows how much I relate to people. Listen, I can't believe there's no relationship between the lack of relating to people and the following statistic. What is it? 25% of Americans aged 40 and younger, 40, have never been married, by far more than ever in American history. Arguably, maybe more than in human history. So I'm just giving you a secondary, the primary problem is the stuff that they will be watching, but the secondary and related is the not relating to people. So what do parents do? They have to limit the time. And they would have to figure out a way, because obviously they don't have a traditional Sabbath where, you know, that Orthodox Jews have. 99% of the society doesn't have that. Although it is worth considering. Of having a day taken away. But I'll tell you, here is why religion is so important. If my son had told his two sons, you can't use social media for 24 hours, one day every week, it would have been a battle in the house. But saying, hey, God wants us to observe a Sabbath, and on our Sabbath, we don't do that. There was no fight. God and religion are a big help for good things. Okie doke. Okay, good. We have a lot of time, theoretically. All right, Ashley in Ogden, Utah, USA. Hi, Dennis. My daughter in college wants to support friends with mental health issues without feeling overwhelmed herself. She's deeply religious, Christian, and always wants to help others, but worries about the stress it may cause to herself. Do you have any advice for her? Wow. Can I say that I talked to you about this beforehand and that you have this issue? Mm-hmm. Well, I really salute your daughter, number one. That's real religion. That's the best. That your daughter has reached out to peers with mental health issues because there's not much in it for her. There, in my religion, Judaism, there is a belief that the greatest rewards go to people who do good for others, knowing there's no way the person can repay them with another favor, let alone money, forgetting money. That's a separate issue. That would be your daughter. The friends with mental health issues can't repay her. Now, you can say that doing good for others is its own good feeling. That's all true. But, I mean, let's be real. It's very tough. So, there might be a better answer than I have to give. I will fully acknowledge that, because this is not an arena that I have explored in any depth. But if she gets overwhelmed, she's of no great use to herself, to you, or to the friend. That's where one has to know. I hope that I can tell this story. I literally never talked about this publicly. But I will, because I think it's an interesting a parallel. I had one such example in my life. In my early years, I began publicly speaking at 21. I have a very odd life, a wonderfully odd life, but odd life. In my late 20s, I gave a speech in Savannah, Georgia. And it was to the Jewish community. And the cantor, the one who led prayers, not the rabbi, but the cantor, in the synagogue that I spoke, really took a deep liking of me, in fact, affection. He was a generation older than me. He had gone through the Holocaust. He lost his entire family, his parents, his siblings, his cousins. Everyone was murdered except him. It damaged him. I mean, he could function professionally, obviously. He had a wife whom he adored. And he opened up to me almost every time we met. If he didn't cry, he was on the verge of crying. I remember he would say to me, "You know, Dennis, normal people, if they want to talk to their brother or sister, they pick up the phone and they call them. Or they invite them to their home. Or they like a certain cousin and they meet with them. Or they talk to a parent. I have nobody to call." So I sort of became, and he said this, he said, God, he would always say this, God sent you to me. So what am I going to say? He didn't send me to you? So I had enormous sympathy for this human being, what he went through and continued to go through. He had nightmares. He would tell me things he saw in the concentration camps, which were horrific. And then he moved to Los Angeles after he retired in Savannah, where I lived. And so I knew I have to visit him periodically. And the reason for my hesitation, it was not easy. In other words, I didn't do it for pleasure. I did it like your daughter. I felt an obligation to this man. And I would invite him to various family events to make him, in effect, give him a family. One of his only child, I don't know how many he had, was estranged somewhat from him. So I became that too. So I know what you're talking about. And I never saw him enough, which is, I'm sure you have with your friend with issues, mental issues. I'm sure your daughter has. There's no perfect answer, but so I walked this tightrope between a feeling of obligation to him. And, you know, I have a life to live too. These things do not allow for perfect answers. But I'll end with one of the guideline sayings for my religion, again, from Judaism. After the Bible, the holiest book in Judaism is the Talmud. It's an enormous work. It's like multiple dozens of volumes. It's enormous. And one of the greatest rabbis of the Talmud said something that any student of Judaism knows, that you learn it in Hebrew, I'll say it in English. If I am not for myself, who will be for me? But if I am only for myself, what am I? That's the tightrope you have to walk. You have to, first, if I don't take care of myself, who will? But second, if I only take care of myself, then what am I? Well, I'm not a good person. So you have to first take care of yourself, and you must take care of others. Good luck on that one. And I mean good luck, and I think you will find it. But you can't let yourself get overwhelmed. Except in the rarest of instances, we're not called to be martyrs. We're supposed to love life and embrace it. Well, let me see. The next one. Oh, maybe I'll do this one. Okay, I could summarize it. Okay. Here is Lou in New Hampshire, 33 years old. He's annoyed with me. Totally understandably. I'm not laughing about it. Because when I was asked, who in the world would I like to most interview, right? And I said, and I disappointed him, and probably more than just him, said, I'd like to interview people who drive slowly in the carpool lanes. It sounds ridiculous, but I'm going to defend it. And I said, and I added, in the nature of my work, I have interviewed virtually anyone I have wanted to, given my radio show, given PragerU. And it's a blessing in my life, the number of people. Basically, I just say to Alan, who is not only the guy who came up with the idea of PragerU and helps run it now, but he's the producer of my radio show. And I will say, Alan, I want to talk to so-and-so. And 99% of the time, they come on. So I said, I also said that I often know what they'll answer, which is not a put down of them. But I know, I've often read them. I know what they think. So he found that disturbing. Do I have nobody I could learn from? I learn from callers who are not famous people. I have said often, I have learned more from the callers to my talk show than from almost any group of human beings. It's been a blessing in my life having a talk show. The reason that I want to interview the person who drives slowly and is blocking a dozen cars, I want to know what goes on in their mind. I want to understand selfish behavior. Again, in many instances, I will know the answer. It's not a put down of those people. I read them and I've spoken to them in many cases. But I really don't understand selfish behavior on the highway. I know it sounds trivial, but I don't think it's trivial. Obviously, it's not up there with murder and rape and horrors like that. But I would like to say, are you aware that that lane is for cars to go faster than others. I want to know what their thinking is. This may not persuade any of you. This may not disturb you. I can only say that I don't like selfish behavior, to be honest. I just don't like it. And I want to understand what animates it. And that's it. That was the entirety of my response. Because I don't know what they'll say. Now he was wise, the questioner, and with this I'll end. Isn't there a great pianist you would like to talk to? Given my love of classical music, I could spend the day talking to classical musicians. But I will tell you, even that I am lucky to be able to do. I once went up to San Jose, California, and I had dinner or late lunch before my talk with six members of the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra, a truly great orchestra. I was in heaven. They were excited to meet me, which I'm very touched about. They don't know. I think I was more excited to meet them. To talk music with great musicians, I admit that would be a tough one. You can talk to great musicians or people who go slowly in the carpool lane or left lane. It would be a toss-up. All right. Thank you. See you next week. The Fireside Chat is made possible thanks to the members of Prager United. So if you like the Fireside Chat, please consider joining Prager United at prageruniteded.com.